Shame. I don't want you cook my bread. I don't want you to make my bed. I don't want you because I'm sad and blue. I just want to make
woman told my mother before I was born, I got a boy child coming. He's gonna be a son of a gun. He's gonna make pretty women jump and shout. Then the world wanna know what this all about. But you know I'm here. Everybody knows I'm here.
I got a black cat bone. I got a mojo too. I got the John the Conqueror. I'm gonna mess with you. I'm gonna make you girls lead me by my hand. Then the world will know the hoochie coochie man. But you know I'm here. On the 7 hours, on the 7 day, on the 7 month, the 7 doctors say he was born for good luck, and that you see, I got $700. Don't you mess with me, but you know, yeah.
Full of money, little doll, don't try to help me, no. She moved me when she get drunk, then she say I'm not nowhere. She call me a dumbbell. She say I'm nothing but a square. She moves me, man. Honey, I don't see how it's done. She got a pocket full of money. The little girl don't try to help me, though. Man, he said, now I'm not so dumb. I take him to a funeral, boy. The dead jumped up and run. She looked at a deaf and dumb boy. Said, now I can speak. She shook a finger in a blind man's face. Watched the blind but not see. She moves me, man. Honey, I don't see how it's done. She got a pocket full of money. The little girl don't try to help me, though.
Yeah.
why you got me standing around crying. You got me standing around crying. I know I don't love you, little girl, but you're always resting on my mind. Automobile. Oh, baby, I ain't gonna be riding you around in my automobile. Get me killed. Oh, baby, you ain't nothing like you used to be.
Can you hear that, George?
You ain't nothing like you used to be. When I was deep in love with you, little girl, you were just sweet as an apple on a tree.
And welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Joining us today is George Werthner, who is an ecologist, a wildland photographer, and author. George teaches field ecology classes, photo workshops, and also guides natural history tours. George has published over 36 books about the environment and public lands. And George, want to thank you for taking time out of your day and being a guest here on the radio.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate you giving me a call.
Now, George, boy, you know, you've been part of the conservation movement, I'll say, for probably 30 years now. Give or take. And you've covered a lot of interesting topics, and you've seen and had a lot of great experiences. What I figured we'd start off today with is Forest Service policy and fire suppression. At some point this summer, the Forest Service decided to issue a policy that called for the suppression of all fires, regardless of where they were burning, including wilderness areas. And I was wondering if you could share with our listeners, what's your take on this turn back the clock policy?
Of course, as an advocate of wildfire, it's disappointing to see the Forest Service take that position. There are so many benefits that come from wildfire in the long run that difficult to watch, especially when they suppress fire in national parks, wilderness areas, and other places, public lands that we have set aside for natural ecological processes to occur. And I hope it's not a permanent change in policy. My understanding, it was done because of a fear of the drought that was occurring in many places, and a fear that if they didn't try to suppress fires, that that would have more acres burned. But in a lot of cases, I think the situation is such that the fire suppression under drought conditions and with wind and so forth is pretty ineffectual, and we may have seen just as much burn this summer as would have happened otherwise, but that the Forest Service, I think, if I am going to second-guess them, probably fears if they did nothing, then people would be, you know, questioning what they're doing, and a lot of political ramifications would result. So you go out and you throw money at these fires, and you hope you have some effect, and in a lot of cases you don't, but at least people won't accuse you of doing nothing.
Yeah, George, that you know, certainly there was a lot of political pressure, I'm sure, put on the Forest Service and other federal land management agencies, particularly after all the fires that were burning down in the Colorado area. Now, recently you penned an article that was ran by the title "Praise the Dead: The Ecological Value of Dead Trees." Do you want to talk a little bit about that article?
Yeah, sure. This is sort of counterintuitive to a lot of people, but we have this sort of bias against dead things, which is quite natural. People don't want to die. They don't want to see their relatives die. But in a forest ecosystem, dead trees serve many important functions. In fact, there's a growing recognition that dead trees may be more critical to the long-term ecological health of forest ecosystems than live trees. And let me give you a few examples. One study suggests that as much as 45% of all bird species use dead trees at one time or another in their lives. It may be, you know, the obvious thing like cavity nesting birds like woodpeckers or bluebirds, but it's also things like roosting by bald eagles, and it's the feeding on dead trees, nut hatches, and so forth. And the same thing applies to many other wildlife species. When the dead trees are on the ground, they provide habitat for mice or marten, and salamanders and frogs, and all sorts of vertebrate and invertebrates, too, as well, that sort of keep the forest going, from ants to various fungi and lichens and so forth. So the dead trees are very important in land situations, forest ecosystems. They're also a storage for nutrients. And then even when they fall into streams, they provide a lot of the habitat for fish and slow erosion on stream banks. And if they get washed all the way out to the sea, like in coastal rivers, they're the habitat for crabs and for mussels and for coho, salmon fingerling, and so forth. So dead trees are a long-term resource, a biological investment in the forest that has been overlooked, and because of our bias, we tend to want to prevent trees from dying in our forest, but they actually need periodic inputs of sort of like you might say a flood on a stream, how it changes the channel and helps, say, cottonwood be established. Periodic input of dead trees are important, and the most important factors in our region for that are like beetles and wildfire. And large beetle kill and large wildfire kill actually are important for recycling the trees and creating the dead wood that's important for forest ecosystems.
Wow. I mean, how cool is ecology? The older I get, the more I realize ecology is where it's at. Now, for those of you that are just tuning in, I want to thank you for listening here to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Today's guest is ecologist, wildland photographer, and author George Werthner. George, I was reading your article, which we were just talking about, Praise the Dead, The Ecological Value of Dead Trees, and I was wondering if you could touch on the relationship between dead trees, ants, and grizzly bears.
Well, that's one of the many interesting relationships. It turns out that in years of berry failure or low berry production, one of the favorite foods of grizzly bears is ants. Same for black bears, too, as well. And you can see this. If you walk around in the forest, you'll often see where logs have been torn apart, where the bears are chomping down on the ants. And that, you know, it's just like I always find it amazing that a bear can live on berries, to tell you the truth. It's even more amazing that they can live on ants. But there's so many of them, and they're high protein. They're the most common invertebrate found in forest ecosystems. And you know, when something's that common, many animals don't overlook that food source. And it's not just bears, of course. You know, flickers feed on ants. Lots of even fish, when they fall into a creek, feed on ants. So ants are an important food source, and a lot of them depend on dead wood in the ground and fallen logs for their habitat. That raises another issue, and that is a lot of the forest management policies we have try to short-circuit or prevent the creation of dead trees, whether it's, you know, earlier conversation we had about forest fire suppression, or logging and thinning forests to prevent beetles from killing the trees, or removing salvage logging, post-fire logging that occurs after a fire or a beetle kill to remove the dead trees. All of those management policies are eliminating either the dead trees that exist and or the future possibility of dead trees. So when you, say, thin the forest so that the beetles don't kill the trees, you're short-circuiting future production of dead trees and then down woody material that's so important for the long-term health of the forest. The way you think about it is like biological capital. It's the capital that keeps the forest ecosystem running. And just like spending the capital, in a savings account, you're gradually bringing down that savings account's value. We're doing the same thing with a lot of our forest management, inadvertently, I think, in a lot of cases, because it's not well known how dead trees fit in the picture. But we really need to appreciate and tolerate, in a lot of cases, things like wildfires or beetle kill, because they're really important for creating that dead wood that keeps the forest ecosystem going.
Well, that's, George, you're spot on. And certainly, you know, this is what I've been learning over the years. And, there's a long history to what you're talking about, smoky bear and fire suppression, up to the salvage logging riders of the 90s. To now the beetle kill mania, maybe like Beetlemania part two. this isn't about George and Ringo and the gang. This is about trees and people wanting to cut them down and a lot of the just rhetoric that comes along with that. Someone recently sent me an article, and it was penned by Idaho Senator Mike Crapel. And it went on to say the title of it, of the, you know, the sub in the subject line of the email to me was "Fire as a Political Tool," and I'm guessing, I want to ask your opinion, but I'm guessing that based on what history has taught us and the amount of fires that we've had throughout the West, particularly all the smoke that's been in the air in places like Moscow and throughout Idaho, I'm guessing we're going to see that fire, let's cut down all the trees because they're dying rhetoric ramp back up.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you have to recognize what's causing the fires right now. In most cases, what we're seeing is a direct result of climate change, or at least the whether you want to argue it's from humans or not is beside the point. The fact is that the fire season is much longer than it used to be. We have some severe droughts in places, and what you see is a direct response to those changes in climate. And it's really difficult to counter such large factors like climate with any kind of forest management, actually. And it's sort of like trying to... not that I'd advocate this, but it would be like trying to eliminate mosquitoes by swatting the ones that land on your arm. You know, it's hardly going to make a difference in the big scheme of things with mosquitoes by doing that. And so we have beetle kill, we have fires and so forth, and that's trying to adjust the forest to the existing climatic conditions. And in a sense, a way you can think about it is things like beetles are thinning the forest, taking out a certain number of trees, and they're very good, the beetles, that is, are very good at selecting which trees are the weakest and the least able to adapt or be genetically fit for the conditions. And they take out those trees and leave behind the trees that are better adapted to the existing conditions. And the forest, as a result, overall, becomes healthier. And I know this is not a popular analogy in a lot of Idaho, but the analogy I might make is how wolves can thin out the weak and the diseased and the injured animals in an elk herd. And the overall elk herd, in the end, is better adapted to conditions and becomes more productive.
Well, George, that's a really good segue into our next topic here. And for those of you that are tuning into the Wild Clearwater Country Show, today's guest is George Werthner, not only a good friend and member of Friends of the Clearwater, but he's a highly respected ecologist, wildland photographer, and author. So George, last time I got a chance to see you, you were embarking on a 3-day tour here in North Central and Northern Idaho, giving lectures on the dynamics of predator ecology. And, for those of our listeners that were not able to attend one of those presentations, I believe you were in Moscow, Coeur d'Alene, and Sandpoint. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the role that predators play, including wolves, on the landscape.
Well, there's a lot of scientific evidence to suggest that wolves and other predators, mountain lions, bears, coyotes, etc., play an important role, regulatory role, you could say, in the ecosystem. By what I said earlier, eliminating diseased animals, eliminating animals that have injuries or just not quite as fit, or making the prey populations fit whatever the available limiting resources, and maybe food in the wintertime or other concerns. And the other thing about wolf predation is that it has the effect of minimizing the oscillations in some of these, particularly with larger big game herds, from getting too great and then having massive die-offs. Those amplitudes are particularly large in populations that don't have predators intact. And the other major thing about predators like wolves and mountain lions and so forth is that there's a whole host of other animals that depend on them. So, for example, ravens, wolverine, other scavengers that may find an animal killed, say wolves kill an elk, it may provide the food for even grizzly bears. Grizzly bears kill an elk, they provide food for maybe a wolverine. All these interconnections where the animals have a role to play in the survival of other species that might otherwise not be able to sustain themselves without at least some of these predator kills.
Well, that's exactly it, George. As I've come to learn, what you're explaining here to our audience is what scientists call a trophic cascade, and one analogy or symbol that I like to use is just a spider web. When you look at a spider web, there's a nucleus, there's a center. And I'm not saying predators are that center, but I look at ecology this way, where it's all connected. And everything, not only is it connected, but it reaches out in all directions. And so just that, wolves have a trophic cascade, or that's their ecological niche. They're kind of top-down predators that are almost like an equalizer in a positive way, an equalizer on the landscape. I'm sure you're aware of this, and maybe you're not. There's been a lot of disturbing news coming out of the state of Washington this week regarding wolf management. It's been reported that two wolves were killed via aerial gunning yesterday. And as we were preparing for this show today, it was reported that three more were killed. And this is the wedge pack that's been in the news lately. The question I had for you, George, is why have state fish and game managers been so slow to adapt to predators on the landscape, particularly wolves? And what do you think the future is for wolf recovery throughout the western landscape?
Well, the thing that I see that needs to happen is we need to, well, for one thing, a lot of the conflicts has to do with livestock production. And for 100 years, the livestock industry has, in a sense, been subsidized by the creation or the killing of predators by, in other words, we created a predator-free landscape. And so they've gotten used to basically sloppy husbandry and animal husbandry. And what that has done, once you get predators back in the landscape like wolves, is create conflicts that are easily resolved by changes in animal husbandry. For example, one of the main attractions to wolves and bears to livestock is dead carcasses left out on the landscape. In some places in Europe in particular, it's been shown that if you remove those carcasses, you have a much, much lower chance of having any predation on your farm or farm animals as a result. And a similar study was done in Montana in the Blackfoot Valley. Same kind of results. When there was quick and immediate removal of dead carcasses, you had a lot less conflicts because the animals aren't attracted into the area where there's live animals. Another thing that's been shown to be very effective is the use of guard dogs and other guard animals and lambing and calving sheds. There's any number of adaptations that could be done that would minimize the conflicts. But the other part of it has to do with the management by the fish and game agencies. There's a growing body of evidence that suggests that when you have indiscriminate predator control, which is what you're having in Idaho, for example, where hunters and trappers are going out and killing wolves, or the same thing would apply to mountain lion and bears for different reasons. But when you do that, you can skew the population to younger animals. You fragment, like in the case of wolves, the packs, so that they're smaller. They're less able to forage and capture native prey. The younger animals are less experienced hunters. They don't know where the elk migration routes are, the calving grounds, and so forth. And then they're much more prone to perhaps prey on livestock. The same thing with the fact that smaller packs are, you have to have some animals back at the den taking care of the pups. If you only have one or two adults out hunting, they're going to be less effective at taking down a big animal like an elk than a pack that has five or six adults. So every time you do these indiscriminate control activities, you may be actually increasing the conflicts with livestock producers. And there have been a few studies, not so much on wolves, but on mountain lion, for example, that have shown that as more control of mountain lions goes up, you have reported more and more conflicts rather than less. And so we really need to rethink predator management and the ideas behind it, because it totally ignores the social ecology of these predators. And they're not just like cogs on a wheel. They are numbers. They have relationships both among themselves as among other predators that influences how they use the landscape. And we ignore that stuff at our peril.
Well, I can listen to this stuff all day, and I hope our audience is enjoying this. Today's guest is George Werthner, ecologist, wildland photographer, and well-established author. George, based on our conversation so far today, I'm thinking about changing the radio show to Mythbuster. whether it's the role that fires play on the landscape or predators, it seems like what we read and what we're told via the mainstream media and society as a whole, what we're finding through science is just the opposite. And that is that, you know, the important role that fire plays on the landscape, including beetles, like we've talked about, and then the really crucial role that predators play on the landscape, and including wolves. Now, maybe we'll switch gears here again. I know you're a big wilderness guy, a wilderness nut, and I am too. And I know you've spent a lot of time, George, in designated wilderness areas throughout the United States, and including Alaska. The question I have for you here is, do we truly have wild wilderness in the lower 48 anymore? And maybe what do you think are some of the challenges that wilderness, quote, managers are facing today?
Well, you know, the answer to that is somewhat subjective in how you define wilderness. My definition is landscapes that are largely self-willed. In other words, under very little manipulation by humans. Now, there are, you know, these deconstructionist people out there that say there's no such place as wilderness any place, because every part of the earth has some influence, for example, climate change, where human influence is occurring. But there are degrees of influence. We can easily see there's a big difference between downtown Moscow and the human influence and footprint there versus, say, the middle of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. And if you look at it as not as an absolute black and white, but matters of degree, then the Selway is definitely a much wilder place, much more self-willed, where natural processes operate much more freely than, say, downtown Moscow. And so in that sense, I think there's quite a bit of wild lands in the lower 48 states. The scale of it, except for a few places like the Selway and River No Return Wilderness, is probably not equal to what you would have in, say, Alaska. The vastness of Alaska is in a league by itself out as part of the United States. But nevertheless, I think there are many areas where one could argue that natural processes are still operating to a large degree, despite our best efforts to prevent them. For example, the fire suppression that occurred in wilderness areas this summer. We still have things like beetle kill and floods and predators and all these things operating on the landscape in various parts of the lower 48 states. And so I would say, to sort of answer your second part of the question, the biggest challenge for a lot of managers is trying to preserve those natural processes and maintain them in the face of political efforts to, control them to some degree.
Now, George, one of the it wasn't a challenge because the legislation has not passed, at least not yet. And that was the Sportsman's Heritage Act. And speaking with people like George Nickus and some of the leaders at Wilderness Watch, they viewed that legislation as a bullseye, a direct aim at gutting the Wilderness Act. Were you able to follow the legislation there known as the Sportsman's Heritage Act?
I haven't followed it real closely, in part because I'm hoping that it won't have any traction. Taking clues from Wilderness Watch and other groups, I mean, there are a lot of groups that are upset and worried about it if it were to become enacted some way. I think at this point, if something like that were to pass, very likely, or at least I would like to hope, that Obama would veto it. But, of course, depending upon the outcome of the next election, that may not be something you can count on if Mitt Romney is elected. So I think the idea behind some of this legislation, like a lot of it that gets introduced, is not that it will be successful in the end, but it sets things up so that if the right opportunity comes along, a change in if the House and the Senate and the presidential seat were all taken over by Republicans, then that that legislation would go forward.
Now, today's guest on the Wild Clearwater Country Show is author, ecologist, and wildland photographer George Werthner. Hope you are enjoying the program here. We got about another 10 minutes with George. And, George, let's talk about the National Park Service. I recently learned that, Yellowstone National Park is currently accepting public comments on their snowmobile and snow coach management plan. And in your opinion, what type of effects are these motorized recreationists having on wildlife during the winter months in the park?
Well, there's been a fair amount of research, particularly on snowmobiles, not so much snow coaches, but the snowmobiles, as they were running in the past, and I qualify that because today the snowmobilers, at least under the current regulations, have to be guided and have a guide that's responsible for their behavior. But in the past, there were problems with both going very fast and rapid on the roads to the point where it endangered wildlife on or near the roads. The noise is one thing that's hard to do anything about. On a quiet day, you can hear the sound of snowmobiles for a couple of miles on either side of the roads they're riding on, so you have a band of 4 or 5 miles wide where, the silence of winter is impacted. And silence is an important resource, you might say, that's increasingly scarce today because almost every place we live, we can hear motors and trains and cars and all those noises. And quiet is... I was actually up on Mount Hood not too long ago, and my son was with me, and the thing he said, it's quiet here. And he noticed it, and that kind of thing is something that's hard to find these days. The other impacts are more controversial, but still, at least in the past, existed, and that was air pollution was tremendously high along the corridor, to the point where park rangers had to wear gas masks. And then there's some concern about pollution from leaking machines and so forth, leaking fuel and other things onto the ground, and that being stored in the snow. So when the snow melts in the spring, there's a flush of these toxic chemicals into the nearby plant communities. But the main thing I think is more of a philosophical thing in the sense of, snowmobiles, for the most part, people like to go fast on them. They like to ride them in a way that's more for thrills, and that is that appropriate in a national park? And, a lot of people think it isn't. So that's a lot of the controversy.
Well, George, we got another segue here. You mentioned the word thrill. Now, I know you are—you authored a book called Thrill Craft, The Environmental Consequences of Motorized Recreation. And I wanted to see if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that book, as well as, in your opinion, is motorized recreation the greatest threat to the health and integrity of our public lands today?
Well, the answer to the first part of your question, the purpose of the book was to bring attention to the fact that unregulated use of motorized vehicles off of roads, this is trail bikes, snowmobiles, ORVs, four-wheelers, whatever you want to call them, was shrinking the landscape in terms of wildlife habitat, refuge for wildlife. Hunters had greater access to a lot of country formerly provided refuge for wildlife. There was damage to trails from the vehicles themselves in terms of damaging trails and stream crossings. There's a spread of weeds that comes with those vehicles because they cover such large distances quickly. They can spread weeds over a great area. And then there's back to the sort of more aesthetic kind of use, the noise, the sense of I don't know what the right term is, but an example would be, a number of years ago, I was hunting in the Caribou Mountains there in Idaho, near Idaho Falls, elk hunting, and I had walked for half a day to this point, following some elk tracks, only to come up on a ridge and meet four guys on four-wheelers, you know, and so it just really deflates you, so to speak, that you put all this effort in, and it was totally achieved by the guys on the ORVs, and they beat me to the elk. Those kinds of things happen, and as a result of all that, and the creation of new trails all the time, and so forth, a lot of the federal agencies have started to push back. They're a little late, I think, in the game, but finally doing it, and creating a situation where in a lot of forests now, and in some BLM lands, unless it's specifically said to be open to ORVs, it is closed to ORVs, and that's the difference, because in the past it used to be, unless it was specifically closed, it was open. And the problem with that kind of approach is it's really easy for somebody to tear down a sign and go, well, I didn't see any sign there. Whereas it's a lot harder to say, if it's closed unless specifically open, for somebody to make that claim. And that was a problem, and it still is. A lot of quite a number of studies that show that those who drive ORVs, a lot of them, just basically ignore closures or signs that say this route is closed and so forth. So making it so closed unless otherwise open is helping to put a lot of controls on it. But then you still see things like the Idaho Fish and Game is a good example. You know, they put out their hunting regulations. They have ads for ORVs. How crazy is that? Promoting their use, which in the end makes hunting worse for everybody. The more access you have, the shorter your seasons are going to be, the less time you're going to have, because the same with a lot of access, the same number of elk or deer or whatever are going to be killed in a shorter time. So it actually compromises everybody's hunting experience or fishing experience and outdoor experience. So I am glad to see the trend towards more regulation and hopefully more places that will be off limits, because that is something that, again, quiet and places without motors are increasingly scarce.
Well, today's guest, for those folks just joining us, is George Werthner, established author, ecologist, and wildland photographer. And George, it has been an absolute joy to have you as a guest today on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Are you got a blog going these days, or how can our listeners follow more of your great and insightful work?
Well, I guess the best way would be to just put in my name in Google, and it'll, you know, I send various articles out and editorials and so forth to all sorts of places where I hope they'll be published. But I do have a blog of my own that I don't keep up to date, though, worth there on the environment. But really, the easiest way is just to put in my name and see what comes up. And I do write articles and editorials pretty frequently, so I think that's the best way for people to turn up some of this stuff.
Well, there you go, the old reliable Google. Google George Werthner, and the guy's got oodles and oodles of information, books, articles, photo galleries, like I said, just a real joy to have you on the show today, George. But before I let you go here, I need you to circle your calendar. Now, I know you're a super busy guy, but Friends of the Clearwater is celebrating their 25th anniversary annual gathering and meeting, or annual meeting and gathering, on Friday, November 2nd here in Moscow. And consider this a personal invitation.
Well, I appreciate that. I'll put it on the calendar and see if I can fit it in. That would be great to come there and celebrate with you guys. And I want to say I really appreciate all the work that Friends of the Clearwater is doing to popularize some of these issues, and also to protect the wildlands of that great part of Idaho, which has some of the most important remaining unprotected wildlands left in the lower 48 states.
Well, George, kudos to that. Certainly we need all the teamwork we can get these days. And thanks again for being a guest on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Hope to see you in November, and can't wait to cross paths with you again.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate being on the show. Bye.
Well, there you go. Phew. Wow. What a great guest. What a great guest. I mean, what a great job I have. I mean, wow. Had the fortune of meeting George a couple times now, and just a dynamic individual that has spent the past three decades or possibly longer studying and exploring and experiencing the landscape, whether it's in the Rocky Mountains or up in Alaska. He's just a wealth of knowledge and just a joy to be around. I mean, if you enjoy topics like this, and I'm assuming that if you're listening, you do, it's just so valuable. You can't underrate it, especially with the mainstream media that we have today. And, you know, when we're fortunate to have radio stations like KRFP Moscow and Friends of the Clearwater. We've been running the show here for 6-7 years. And, I mean, give it up for KRFP Moscow. I mean, they allow us to have this platform. And so please do support your community radio station. Check out the website for the group or the organization, www.krfp.org, krfp.org. And check out the new website by Friends of the Clearwater, www.friendsoftheclearwater.org. So there you go. Let's take a quick music break, and then we'll come back, wrap up the show, and go from there. This is KRFP, Moscow.
Well, lies to as two trains running. Well, ain't now one hole going my way. Well, now one run at midnight, the other one running just for days. They're running just for days. It's running just for days. Long
She's so long and tall. Tell she weep like, oh, I will too. Well, Lottie says she's no good, but she's all right. She's all right with me. She's all right.
All right, welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show, and once again, thank you, George Werthner, for being a guest today on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Our program here is every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m., and so we'll see what the month of, we got to line up some guests here for October and continue the quality wildland programming, hopefully that you're enjoying. I certainly have been over the past couple weeks. Now, let's take a look at the weather. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 45 degrees. Winds will be out of the north around 6 miles an hour. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 76. Winds will be out of the east around 5 miles an hour, calming in the morning. Thursday night, mostly clear with a low around 48. Winds will be calm. Friday, mostly sunny with a high near 77. Winds will be light out of the west between 5 and 8. Friday night, partly cloudy with low around 49. Winds will be out of the west between 5 and 9 miles an hour. Saturday, welcome to your weekend, mostly sunny with a high near 75. Saturday night, mostly clear with low around 47. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 77. Sunday night, mostly clear with low around 47. Peaking at Monday, sunny with a high near 77. And Monday night, mostly clear with a low around 47. Again, hope you've enjoyed the program today. And you've been listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show, KRFP, Moscow.
KRFP thanks its donors and underwriters, including
Mikey's Gyros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine such as gyros, falafel, hummus, tabbouleh, and spanakopita, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
Kochira wa KRFP Moscow, Idaho, 米国.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi, Policy Director with the National Iranian American Council, who talks about the dangerous rise in tensions between the U.S. and Iran just 6 weeks before the U.S. presidential election. Ben Beachy of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who describes the many concerns labor, consumer, and environmental groups have with ongoing secret negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Andrew Kukurowski, research associate with the Prison Policy Initiative, who explains why his group has launched a campaign to pressure the FCC to roll back the exorbitant expense of prison phone calls. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the run-up to a dialogue about global water security at the United Nations General Assembly meeting in New York, a coalition of high-level former government officials, the Interaction Council, has issued a set of policy recommendations. The group is urging global action on water conservation, major investment in water